we are reinstituting holidays that already existed. So we see two strains of thought. The more predominant theme is that Hanukkah is not a new holiday. And so you don't see the word Hanukkah until the rabbinic period. In Second Temple sources, you see a variety of terms for this holiday that mostly relate to Sukkot. So in the oldest sources that we have about Hanukkah, what Hanukkah is the holiday of Sukkot in December, in the winter, because they couldn't celebrate the holiday of Sukkot in the fall that year, of course, because they did not have access to the temple. And so in the Book of 1 Maccabees, the author needs to make a case that this holiday needs to be observed by all Jews everywhere for perpetuity. And so this is something that needs to be marketed. And so I'm not going to go through all the details of the war, although I think that this passage is very interesting because this opens up the story by targeting not the Syrian Greeks, those Greeks who follow Antiochus Epiphanes, but the enemy in the story of Maccabees is Judeans who are following in Hellenized ways. And I guess I should back up just by clarifying again, I'm sure many of you know this, we're not talking about all Greeks in this story. So I know as children, we all learn Jews versus Greeks. We're talking about Judeans versus one of the three major Greek empires at the time. So it's not an imminent culture clash. Just to back up a little bit, Alexander the Great dies in 323 BCE. This is sort of the beginning of Hellenism, right? So way before 175 BCE, way before the war. When he dies, he doesn't leave a will. His empire is divided into three major parts. The Ptolemaic Greeks in North Africa and Egypt, the Antiochid Greeks in the east in Asia, and the Seleucid Greeks in the north of Judea. And so there are three major empires as of 323 that are all Hellenist. Now, right in the middle of this, it's very important to understand this, to understand what happens in 175 BC. Right in the middle of these three empires is Judea. So Judea is prime real estate connecting these three major empires. The Seleucids to the north, Antiochids to the east, and the Ptolemies to the southwest. And so it's prime real estate. It's a trade route. Everybody wants it. The Ptolemies and the Seleucids are at war with each other on and off for the entire 4th century BCE. They engage in a series of wars called the Six Syrian Wars. But when Judea is under Ptolemaic rule, things are okay. The problem is in 200 CE, Judea comes under Seleucid rule. And Antiochus IV Epiphanes, who's a Seleucid king, says, these Jews need to be good Hellenized, good citizens of the Greek Empire, and so they cannot keep to their ancestral law. And so in 1 Maccabees, we don't see a culture clash between Greeks and Jews. In fact, the biggest enemy for the author is those Jews from within who are adopting the customs of Antiochus IV Epiphanes. And so he says over here, many from Israel gladly adopted his religion. They sacrificed to idols. They profaned the Sabbath, right? And many of the people, everyone who forsook the law, the nomos in Greek, which actually means Torah. I don't think law is a good translation here, joined these Greeks and they did evil in the land. And they drove the good Jews, right, the Hasmoneans and their followers, into hiding. But I want to take you to the very end of this source because I want to focus on the establishment of the holiday. That's the focus over here. And what's interesting about this one eyewitness story, we only have one eyewitness text to the Hanukkah story, and we don't have reference to the oil miracle, and we don't have the word Hanukkah. What's the origin of this holiday? On the 25th day of the 9th month, because of course we're counting from Nisan, which is Kislev, in the 148th year, they rose and they offered sacrifice as the law directs at the very season, on the very day that the Gentiles had profaned it. It was dedicated with songs and harps and lutes, etc. Judas and his brothers and all the assembly of Israel determined that every year at that season, the days of dedication should be observed with joy and gladness. So here, the word Hanukkah, yes, maybe, you know, Hanukkah does mean dedication. We don't have the Hebrew, but this is the days of dedication of the altar should be observed. It doesn't seem like there's really a name yet for this holiday at this early stage. All we know is that these are the days of dedication of the altar. The focus of this book is the military victory of the Jews, the Hasmoneans and their followers, over the Syrian Greeks. Now, what you get in 2 Maccabees is a very, very different account. The emphasis for the writer of 2 Maccabees, who's writing in Greek, again, writing for a diasporan audience, not an eyewitness to the story, is that he has to make a marketing argument to a diasporan audience that this story has relevance to them. So what do you do when you have a story about a war that only a small percentage of Judeans or Jews in the world experience? Because at this time, there are Jews spread out all over the Greco-Roman Empire. There are millions of Jews. There are probably a million Jews alone in Egypt. And you hear about this story. He's in Cyrene in North Africa, and he hears about this story, and he probably has sources that he's working with, and he says, this is a holiday that we need to be observing in the diaspora. What do? You can't emphasize the military victory because your audience in the diaspora didn't experience it. So that's not resonant. What the author of 2 Maccabees has to do is he has to argue for the theological significance of the story. Because if you argue that the story symbolizes something, and what it symbolizes is God's everlasting commitment to the covenantal promises of old, and all Jews, wherever they live, are subject to those promises, then you can universalize and you can theologize the holiday and say every Jew, even those Jews who did not themselves experience this war, should be observing it as an affirmation of God's protection of the Jewish people. And the way that 2 Maccabees makes this argument is that he over-theologizes. So what's interesting is that the eyewitness account, 1 Maccabees, doesn't have miracles in the story. But 2 Maccabees, written in Greek, is very stylized and actually includes some very, very interesting miracles. So, for example, I think that I have it over here. It opens up with a moment of crisis when a Seleucid general named Heliodorus is about to invade the temple treasury and take all the gold and silver out of the treasury. And as he's about to do this, it's at the beginning of 2 Maccabees, as Heliodorus is about to invade the Jerusalem treasury, we're told when he arrived at the treasury with his bodyguard, then and there, the sovereign of spirits and of all authority caused a manifestation, a vision, a miraculous vision, that all who had been so bold as to accompany him were astounded by the power of God. And what's the vision? There appeared to him a magnificently caparisoned horse with a rider of frightening mien. It rushed furiously at Heliodorus, struck at him with front hooves. Its rider was seen to have armor and weapons of gold. Okay, so he sees this beautiful, decked out military horse. This is what Heliodorus sees. And then he sees 2 young men also who appear to him, remarkably strong, gloriously beautiful, and splendidly dressed. And they stand on either side of him and they just beat him up. And Heliodorus gets so freaked out that he runs away and he does not invade the temple. Now, what is this story doing in 2 Maccabees? It could be that it was a story that was circulating orally among Jews at this time. And I'm not here to comment on the historicity of the story, but it's in the story because it opens up and it foreshadows the way that the author interprets the entire story of Hanukkah, which is that God is intervening into the affairs of the crisis of the Jews in order to protect them, whether that intervention is a military one or a miraculous one doesn't matter to the author as much as the fact that the Jews have the guarantee from God that they will be saved. And so the writer opens up with a story about Heliodorus being beaten up by 2 good-looking angels who chase him away from the treasury. In the middle of 2 Maccabees, we also have a very, very famous story of the mother of the 7 sons, who is not named at this early stage, but this is the earliest version of the story that we have it. In the medieval period, she becomes associated with Hannah, but in 2 Maccabees 7, we have this little standalone novella, which acts as the narrative climax of the story. It's right in the middle of the book, and each of her 7 sons are told by the king to violate their dietary laws, and one by one, they refuse, and they're subject to horrible tortures. And by the way, if you want to know something gross, but maybe you'll find it cool, if you want to know why many of us eat latkes or fried food on Hanukkah, you have to look no further than the way that one of the sons is killed by being fried to death in a pan. We can save that for the Q&A, but he is fried to death in a pan. So the horrible tortures. But what's very significant about the story of Hannah, and I don't have the whole thing here. I actually included the pan scene. Oh my gosh. What's significant is that at the very end of the story, she says to the smallest child, and her name is not Hannah. She's a mother, an unnamed Jewish mother. But what's very interesting is that she says to the youngest child, first of all, the writer of 2 Maccabees tells us that she spoke to him in Hebrew so that the king would not understand her. And she whispers to him in Hebrew and she says, "Let yourself be martyred because I know that God is going to bring you back to me again." And this is an allusion to resurrection. And resurrection is not an idea that appears prominently in Tanakh. You have it a little bit in Yechezkel, a little bit in Daniel, but this is one of the earliest full articulations of what becomes a very, very important rabbinic idea, which is that we believe in Tchiyat HaMetim, we believe in resurrection. So it's a very, very significant story, and we find it for the first time in this diasporan Greek text, 2 Maccabees. But again, let's go to this passage here where the holiday is established. Here, we do not have a reference to the days of purification. Here we have an argument. This is not a new holiday. Again, the author of this book has to make a marketing argument that all diasporan Jews should observe this holiday. And so he says, but it's not a new holiday. It's not anything radical. It's not anything, iconoclastic, right? Why is this holiday established? Well, look at the end of 2 Maccabees. The purification of the sanctuary took place on the 25th day of Kislev. They celebrated in the manner of the festival of booths. So this is nothing other than Sukkot. But it matches, it correlates with the story of Hanukkah. Why? Because they remembered how not long before they were wandering the mountains and caves, right? Hiding from the Seleucids from 175 to 164 BCE. They're on the run like the Israelites were in the wilderness for 40 years. And so creating that correlative narrative situates the story into this biblical continuum, which suggests to the readers that we today are subject to God's salvific promises, God's promises of salvation, just as the ancient Israelites. And so this day is nothing other than another Sukkot where we remember running in the wilderness, maybe not in whatever, 1250 BCE, after running away from Pharaoh, from Ramses II, but in 175 BCE when we were running away from Antiochus for Epiphanes. And so they offer thanksgiving and they give success to the purifying of his own holy place, et cetera, et cetera. And so in 2 Maccabees, we do not have a new holiday that commemorates a military war. We have an old holiday that is theologized. And furthermore, I would say that in the ancient world, this might be significant, Sukkot is associated with a new year. This is something that gets lost in the rabbinic period and many of us don't know. But if you look at Zechariah Yadalid, which I don't have over here, but the very, very end of Zechariah, there is this image of the end time, the messianic return of all exiles streaming back to Judea. And what do? They observe Sukkot. In the ancient Near East, this agricultural fall festival was associated with a new year holiday that the Israelites retained, even when they attribute it to the period of the wilderness. There is this association between this renewal and the holiday of Sukkot. And so perhaps in 2 Maccabees, we have all this bundled into one. We have this renewal, rededication, festival of booths. But the real question that I'm getting at is Jews in the diaspora and Jews in the Judea are engaged in a conversation in the late 2nd century BC. And the conversation is this a new holiday or not? And 1 Maccabee says, yes, it commemorates a military victory. And 2 Maccabee says, no, all we're doing is we're having a Sukkot-like celebration in December. There isn't really clarity on what Hanukkah is and how it should be celebrated until the early rabbinic period. And before I show you some very fascinating sources that are preserved at the very, very end, or maybe beginning of the, at the, or in the very, very late second century BC, before I get to this source, I want to speed forward to the late first century. I'll actually just show it to you. The late first century CE historian Josephus. Because Josephus, who lives, he's born in around 37. He dies in about 100. He has four major works. He has an autobiography where he talks about his role in the Jewish War. He has another history called the Jewish War. It's seven volumes about the Jewish rebellion between 66 and 73 CE. He has a 20-volume work called Antiquities of the Jews, which recalls all Jewish history starting with the beginning of Genesis. And he has the first systematic defense of the Jewish religion ever to be produced, and that is called Against Appian. So Josephus, who a lot of my Jewish friends think is totally unreliable and a traitor and just a garbage historian, and if you are curious about that, I could talk to you about it at the end of this talk. I think Josephus is not a garbage historian. I think he's a very important historian, but I want to show you what he says in Antiquities. Remember, Antiquities is a 20-volume history of the Jewish people starting from the beginning of Genesis, and he says something very interesting about the Hanukkah story in Antiquities in Book 12, where he recalls the story of the Hasmonean Rebellion. He goes through all the wars, and he definitely has sources that we don't have, and he has one Maccabees, but he has other sources too, and he's going through all of the of these details of the war, and he says, and you know what? The Jews called this holiday, and remember, he's writing the 90s CE. He says they called it lights. Now, we don't have that in 1 Maccabees, and we don't have that in 2 Maccabees, and we don't have any allusion to an oil miracle, a menorah-related miracle in 1 Maccabees or 2 Maccabees. Why would Josephus say this? Right? So you're jumping from 1 and 2 Maccabees are written in the 140s and 130s BC. Now you're jumping, I'm bad at math, but 230 years later in the 90s CE, and Josephus says, they dedicated the temple, they established a festival, they called it lights. Why? Now, the amazing thing about this source is that Josephus doesn't know. He does not know. All he knows is that that's what they call it. And then he kind of like fishes around for maybe some kind of allegorical reason. I suppose the reason was, this liberty beyond our hopes appeared to us, and thence was the name given to that festival. Like, there was darkness, allegorical darkness, and then there was allegorical light. This is not a satisfactory answer, right? Because you could really apply that to any bad thing that then gets resolved, right? We call the lights because it was bad and then it was good. Josephus, bottom line, does not know why, by the 90 CE, Jews are calling this the Festival of Lights. But the fact that they are suggests that there could be a historical kernel in the later rabbinic texts about the miracle of the oil. And what we're going to do for the next half hour is try to find that kernel. Now, that kernel is preserved, I think, in an ancient letter that almost no Jews know about, because it's not preserved in the Hebrew Bible. And, you know, we don't read anything if it's not in the Hebrew Bible. If it's on Tanakh and it's not in rabbinic text, we just sort of ignore it. But this is a very, very significant text. So I'm going to go back. Manuscripts of 2 Maccabees don't start the story in chapter 1, verse 1. At some point in the first century BCE, a scribe or an editor was copying over the work known as 2 Maccabees, and he decided to attach two ancient letters to this work. Two ancient letters that were written, authentic letters, all scholars agree, that were written by the Jerusalem community to Greek-speaking Jews living in Egypt. So if you open up any book of 2 Maccabees today, you will not open up and see the beginning of 2 Maccabees. What you're going to see are two letters. And these letters, like I said, authentic letters, were written because the Jerusalem leaders were begging the Greek-speaking Jews living in Egypt to observe the holiday of Hanukkah. These letters contain information that might give us some clue as to how the miracle of oil got started, or at least help us understand what this Festival of Lights term is all about. The first letter is very, very fascinating. It's dated to 124 BCE. It's a little bit less where my focus is going to be, but I'll go through it because it's very short.
And what you're going to see also is that, you know, usually, like, if you go to a shir, if you go to a shir by Hanukkah, you'll hear a teacher say, the rabbis theologize the holiday of Hanukkah, but everyone before them, all the Jews before them, focus on the military aspect of the story. And that's just not true. Because here we have 124 BC, a late second century BCE text, theologizing the story of Hanukkah and suppressing the military aspect only 40 years after the story actually happened. The Jews in Jerusalem and those in the land of Judea, to their Jewish kindred in Egypt, greetings and true peace. May God do good to you. May he remember his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. May he give you all a heart to worship him and to do his will with a strong heart and willing spirit. On and on and on. We are praying for you here. Now we have this date because it dates it in the reign of Demetrius. Now, actually, this is a little bit of an interesting historical nugget. How do I know this is from 124 BCE? Because it says in the reign of Demetrius in the 169th year, they count in the second century BCE from the beginning of the Seleucid era. So they're counting from 311, right? They don't know about, they don't know BCE or CE, right? And there's no year zero, by the way. It goes from 1 BCE to 1 CE. There's no zero. They're counting from 311. So that's how we get this. That actually takes us to 143 BCE, but here he's, let me explain. There's a letter in the letter. So the letter opens in 124 BC, and it says, in the 169th year, so in 143 BC, right after the temple was rededicated, we wrote to you. In the critical distress that came upon us in those years, I'm not going to go into all this history, we wrote to you, and now we're writing to you again. We have another request for you. There's a ton of scholarship on what this is talking about. But we wrote to you 2 decades ago in 143, now it's 124, we're writing to you again, and we have a request, and the request is, keep the festival of booths in the month of Kislev in the 180th year. That takes us to 124 BCE. So in 124 BCE, these Jews in Jerusalem write a letter, keep the festival of booths in Kislev. Now, is this like one Maccabees or two Maccabees? They're writing from Jerusalem, so you would think that they'd be relying on one Maccabees, which is a Jerusalemite text written in Hebrew. And this document is originally written in Hebrew Aramaic. But no. This letter is referring to the festival of booths just like two Maccabees that diasporan work does. And so Jews, whether they're in diaspora or Judea, even by the end of the second century BCE, are still viewing this holiday through the lens of Sukkot, theologizing the holiday and suppressing the aspect of the military victory. Why? Well, maybe it's because their audience, again, like two Maccabees, their audience is diasporan. So one Maccabees, the audience is Judean, Hebrew-speaking Judeans. But if your audience is diasporan, it's not compelling to tell those diasporans about a military victory that didn't happen to them, right? Celebrate this thing every year because something good happened to us. Somebody wants to kill us and God didn't let them. No, but when you say God did a miracle because God made ancient promises to all of us, and therefore today it happened to us and tomorrow it could happen to you. And that interpretation of the military conflict and the military victory, that makes an argument to these Jews living in Egypt. Maybe this is something that we should keep. But whatever this is, it's not quite Hanukkah. And I want to bring you to this very, very difficult letter. Remember, I said there are two letters appended to the beginning of two Maccabees. This is a very, very hard letter. Now, the good news is, first of all, it's long. The good news is that you could easily access this online if you have the curiosity and the inclination to do so. You could easily Google two Maccabees and read this on your own. Like I said, I'm happy to also send you the source sheet. This is a very tough letter. And I wish I could do it line by line, but I can't. Now, the letter is set in 164 BCE. Scholars think that it's a forgery because there's some historical misinformation, but not a forgery in the sense that it was written in the 12th century, right? It's not medieval. This was probably written in 103 or 102 BCE. And there are all kinds of reasons. This is a late second century BCE document, because again, there are a few historical errors. But it's attributed to none other than Judah Maccabee. And there are a few scholars who say that this is authentic and that this is written by Judah Maccabee. Again, it's an open question. To me, it doesn't matter so much. The point is, this is a second century document written by Judean authorities to the Jews of Egypt. And this is going to get very complicated, but I think that this is the linchpin to helping us understand Hanukkah. The Jews in Jerusalem and those in Judea, to their Jewish kindred in Egypt, greetings and true peace. Very typical Semitic Hebrew way of opening up a letter in ancient times. May God do good to you. You always open up with a blessing. You open up with, just like today, you open up with a prayer. May he give you all the heart to worship him and to do his will with a strong heart and a willing spirit. Wait a second. No, I just, that's the first letter. I'm so sorry. Nobody corrected me. I guess everybody's on mute. Okay, that's the first letter. But the second letter opens with the same, with a blessing. The people of Jerusalem and of Judea and the Senate, that's the Gerusia, it sort of means like a Sanhedrin, a group of elders, and Judas. So all these people are writing the letter to someone named Aristobulus. This is a Jew with a Greek name, who is of the family of anointed priests, the teacher of King Ptolemy. We don't know if that's really true. And to the Jews in Egypt. So who's writing this? Maybe Judah Maccabee, maybe somebody writing in his name, or maybe a different Judah in the late 2nd century BC. Greetings and good health. Okay. I am going to not do this paragraph, but this paragraph is about the miraculous death of Antiochus IV Epiphanes. And it sets the stage for the rest of the letter, having been saved by God out of great dangers. We thank him greatly for taking our side against the king. And then it goes through this parenthetical explanation of the death of the king. But look at what it says right away. It doesn't wait till the end of the letter to say, on the 25th day of Kislev, we're going to celebrate the purification. We thought it necessary to notify you in case you also might want to celebrate the festival of booths and the festival of fire. What is going on here? Now we have two different holidays. This is complicated, right? In 1 Maccabees, we have now, I'm like myself getting confused. 1 Maccabees, we have the days of the dedication. In 2 Maccabees, we have the festival of booths, right? Later, Josephus calls it lights. He has no idea why. The first letter calls it the festival of booths. And now we have this combination, the festival of booths and the festival of fire. What is this fire? Well, the writer goes through a very lengthy explanation to clarify what this festival of fire is. And he tells a story. And this is the story. And again, you can look it up on your own. He says, at the very beginning of the Babylonian exile, in 586 BCE, when the Judeans were being dragged by force by the Babylonians out of Judea, as it says when our ancestors were being led captive to Persia, but of course in 586 BC, this would have been Babylonia. What did the pious priests do? The pious priests hid fire from the altar. They took fire. Now, maybe it was from the menorah. Maybe it was from the altar. Well, it says from the altar, but I want you to start thinking about what you know about the Hanukkah story. Okay, so they take fire from the altar and they hide it. Okay, the pious priests of that time, they take some of the fire and they secretly hide it in the hollow of a dry cistern, and they don't tell anybody where it is. Years later, in the 530s and 520s, or in the early 5th century BC, we don't exactly know when Nehemiah lives, but when Nehemiah is getting the Judeans to go back to Judea, the Babylonian exile is over. Persia has conquered Babylonia. The Judeans can now go back and rebuild their second temple. And by the way, this program of Nehemiah to get Judeans to leave Babylonia and go to Judea, overall, we can call it a supreme failure, because only 43,000 Jews go back. Most do not. And that's an important historical piece of information to have. But in any case, when Nehemiah is taking Jews back to Judea, they find it, right? But instead of fire, they find a thick liquid. And he says, well, let's see what we could do with this thick liquid. It doesn't look like fire, but I'm pretty sure that this derives from the fire. Well, let's see what we can do here. And so the writers tell the Jews living in Egypt in the late 2nd century BCE, when the materials for the sacrifices were presented, Nehemiah had the priest sprinkle the liquid on the wood and on the things laid upon it. And when this had been done and some time had passed, a great fire blazed up. A miracle happened. This liquid that derived from fire from the first temple was placed on the altar and it miraculously alit. This was considered such a great miracle that Nehemiah uttered a prayer of thanksgiving to God because this incident was interpreted as a sign of God's favor over what the people were doing and the progress, the process of restoration. And so Nehemiah offers this prayer. Again, I'm not so concerned about whether it happened exactly the way that the letter writers are saying it happened. I'm more interested that this letter is being sent to Jews in Egypt and saying to them, this is a story of a miracle that concerns God's covenantal promises as they apply to every single Jew, even Jews who've been in exile. Because Nehemiah and the Jews with him have come from exile. And so what is the message being sent, being conveyed to those Jews in Egypt? Just as those Jews of old, centuries ago, who came back to Judea from exile, found favor with God so much so that God made a miracle and ignited this liquid from the first temple. So too you can be subject to God's favors and God's miraculous protection, parentheses, if you come back. There is a clear theological implication here. Now, on the surface, this letter is saying, please celebrate Hanukkah. But the subtext is, this story is about you, not only about us. Now, the letter goes on and on. First, it talks about Nehemiah's great prayer of thanks to God for miraculously igniting this mysterious liquid. But then it goes back in time. It goes back to Jeremiah and it says, but you know what? Yirmiyahu was the one who told the priests to hide the liquid. So this story actually goes all the way back in time to the time of the great prophet, Yirmiyahu. But it doesn't only go back to Yirmiyahu. In fact, maybe it goes back to King Shlomo, because King Shlomo was the one, the letter says, who for the first time offered sacrifice for the dedication and the completion of the temple. He builds the temple. And then it takes us back to Moshe. But really, the story goes all the way back to Moshe, because it was Moshe who first prayed to the Lord and fire came down from heaven and consumed the sacrifices. So what, again, is the argument of this letter? It's not that you should be celebrating a holiday that only celebrates the events of 175 to 164 BC, but you should be celebrating a holiday that affirms the continuous favors that God bestows upon those who properly worship in the temple. And so we end. Since therefore, we're about to celebrate the purification, we write to you, will you therefore please keep the days? It is God who has saved all his people, even you, that's the implication, and has returned the inheritance to all, and the kingship and the priesthood and the consecration. In other words, we've rededicated our temple for the first time since the first temple period, right? Because even after the exile, the Jews are not under their own hegemony, right? They're under the Persians and they're under the Greeks. And so it's only in 164 BC that they get independence in the way that they had independence in the first temple period. So this is a miracle, right? It can be theologized. We have hope in God that he will soon have mercy on us and will gather us from everywhere. Now, I love this because this is ancient passive-aggressive. Oh, I just deleted it. Ancient passive-aggressive rhetoric, right? We hope that God will gather us from everywhere, i.e. we hope you come to us soon and worship alongside us in this newly dedicated temple. And so I think that this is a very, very significant document, because it tells us a very early account of the story, right? It's not the rabbis who theologize the story. It's not the rabbis who make this association of miraculous light and the story of Hanukkah, but it's the very people whose grandparents fought in the war. So very, very early on, Jews are interpreting this in a theologized, in a miraculous way. It's not really about the military victory. It's really about God's involvement. And so, yes, Hanukkah on the face of it celebrates the Hasmonean's purification of the temple, but it has ancient roots. And what it does, according to this letter, is it celebrates a series of miraculous purifications of the Beit HaMikdash. So we've already done Josephus, but maybe we've answered the question that Josephus has. maybe the answer to his question, because he doesn't know why by the end of the first century it's called the Holiday of Lights. Maybe it's because there were stories about miracles happening. Maybe it was the miracle preserved in the Talmud, or maybe it was other stories. But there were stories circulating very, very early on that miracles were happening in the Beit HaMikdash. And these miracles had to do with fire. And these miracles had to do with light. And so, Josephus, we can now tell you the answer to your question. There were stories in the second century BCE that miracles were happening in the temple. And because of that, this was a holiday that had theological relevance to all Jews, not just the Jews who experienced the war. Now we can go to my Hanukkah, right? Let's go to the rabbinic text. The rabbis taught on the 25th of Kislev, commences the days of Hanukkah. Right now we have this name, the name, right? The name means dedication, which we do see in 1 Maccabees, but not in any of the other sources. For when the Greeks entered the temple, they defiled all the oils, and the Hashmonaim prevailed against them and defeated them. They made search. They found only one little crucible. This is the famous story that we all have. And I think that what we've done is we've found some nuggets, some stories that go back 7 centuries before this was written down that associate this story with some miracle of lights. Now, what's very interesting is that the rabbis do suppress the military aspect of the story. And there are many reasons for why they do. And I think that there is a reason that I do find to be very compelling. And then I'll end with maybe one or two interesting sources over here. The rabbis are not interested in having another rebellion by the 5th century CE. In the 1st century and the early 2nd century, we have a series of Jewish rebellions against the Roman Empire. It's not just 66 to 73 CE. And we all think, oh, the Beit HaMikdash fell in 70 CE, so that was the worst year ever. But this was a long war. It was a 7-year war, 66 to 73. It wasn't just a year. It was a very, very long war. And it wasn't the only war. The Jews rebelled in the 30s CE. They rebelled in the 50s CE. They rebelled in 115 to 118 CE. They rebelled in 132 to 135 CE. We have documentation, Roman and Jewish, that the Jews are rebelling. They refuse to accept the yoke of Roman occupation. Now, for good reason, the Romans are very cruel overlords, and the Jews remember a time when they lived independently, right? They remember that period of Hashmonai independence with a lot of nostalgia. And so part of what is motivating these Jews to fight against the Romans is not that they think that they're stronger than the Romans, but simply that they think if God could do a miracle for us in 164 BC, why can't he do a miracle for us again, right? Maybe we're not strong, and maybe there's no logical reason that we should be able to defeat the Romans, but there wasn't any logical reason in 164 either. If this is a story about God intervening on our behalf and protecting the integrity of our Beit HaMikdash, then why can't it happen again? But by 135, the catastrophic consequences of all these rebellions against the Roman Empire, it's so devastating that the rabbis say enough. Right, and 135 is a famous war with Bar Kokhba. We have a lot of rabbinic antagonism towards Bar Kokhba. So the rabbis don't call him Bar Kokhba. Bar Kokhba is a play on words. It comes from a phrase in Bamidbar that a son of a star is going to come and save the people on the branch of David. And Jews in the early 2nd century were interpreting this verse as a prediction of the coming of the Messiah. And so this individual whose name maybe we don't know called himself Shimon Bar Kokhba. But the rabbis call him Shimon Bar Kosiba, because Kosiba in Aramaic means deceit. So he is Shimon, the bearer of deceit, because he's bringing these people to their deaths. He's getting thousands of followers to rebel against the Roman Empire, and they're being massacred. Hundreds of thousands of them, maybe even 250,000 Jews are killed between 132 and 135 because of this war. And so by the 2nd century, the rabbis say, we're not supporting these rebellions anymore. Now, we are going to remember the ways in which God protects the people. And we're going to remember the ways in which we see divine intervention in our own lives and divine protection of the integrity of our ritual and our sacred spaces. But we are not going to rebel. And so there is absolutely, I think, an intentional suppression of the military victory, because the rabbis don't want to incite another rebellion. Now, what's very interesting, though, is that in Shona Esrei, we do have reference to the war. So many have asked me, well, I used to not include the source when I teach about these things, but many have said, but, you know, they didn't really suppress it, because every day at Hanukkah, we're reading liturgy, early medieval, late rabbinic, that celebrates the war, right? This is all familiar to any of us who pray, who daven, Bimei Matityahu ben Yochanan, Kohen Gadol Chashmonai Ivanav, okay, da-da-da-da-da. And it goes through the story, you know, I'll just do the English, but then I'll go back to the Hebrew. When the wicked kingdom of Greece stood against your nation Israel to force them to abandon your Torah, to remove them from the statutes of your will, you in your great mercy stood in their defense at the time of troubles. How is this different from 1 Maccabees, which also emphasizes the military victory? How is it different? Well, it's very different, because 1 Maccabees is all about acknowledging and affirming and celebrating the victories of the Hashmonai family. But look at what we say every day of Hanukkah in the liturgy. Ata berachamecha amadat alehem be'etzaretam. You, God, did this. Not Judah Maccabee, not Matityahu, his father, not his siblings. Ravta et rivam, danta et dinam, nakamta et mikotam, and on and on and on. This is an acknowledgement that whatever it was, whether it was a theological miracle or a military victory, it doesn't matter, because God, it's always you. It's not about human prowess, human strength. So this is actually undermining the message of 1 Maccabees. We only won because God willed it. And so, yes, it does review the military clash, but it interprets it as the act of God and therefore a miraculous event in itself. Right? Everything is second person singular here. You did this for us, God. We didn't do it. You intervened in the war. So we have a reemergence of remembering the military battle in the rabbinic imagination, but it really places God at the center of this victory. Now, in Pesik Rabati, which is a very interesting early medieval midrash, we have, I think, just a very fascinating little hint of militarism, and it's fun, and I'm going to share it with you. So then we have a parallel Migilat Ta'ani, but this is a little line from Pesik Rabati. Lama madlik nerot b'chanukah, right? Why do we light lights on Chanukah? B'sha'ay shenitzchu banav shel Chashmonai. When the sons of the Chashmonai, HaKohen Gadol, when the Chashmonai family defeated Malchut Yavan, they entered the temple. Nichnasu lebeit hamikdash, entered the temple, and what did they find? They found Matzu Sham Shmonat Shipudin. They found 8 iron spears, Shel Barzel, v'kivu otam v'hidliku b'tochan nerot. So this is very, very interesting. What was this dedication in 164 BCE that we speak of, that we celebrate? Well, when the Chashmonai family finally regained access to the Beit HaMikdash, they entered it and they found spears, and that was the menorah that they used that year. So this is a really clever and fascinating fusion of the military images that we have in the Second Temple sources with the very miraculous images that come to the fore in the rabbinic period. They take the weapons that the Greeks use and they elevate them and they spiritualize them. And so I think it's a really elegant way of fusing both traditions into one. But the point is that from a very, very early stage, Jews are thinking about how to interpret this in a way that's meaningful for all Jews, even those who did not experience the war. And so even by the early 2nd century BC, there are stories circulating about miracles that are happening in the Beit HaMikdash, miracles having to do with light and fire, that are speaking and resonating very, very deeply with Jews in the diaspora, so that by the 1st century, Jews all over the Greco-Roman world are celebrating this as a profoundly meaningful holiday, even if they don't, like Josephus, remember its exact origins. I'm now going to stop and invite anybody who has any questions to ask or make a comment. We have a few minutes left. And what I can do is put my email in this chat if you have any questions, and I'm also glad to send you the source sheet. I Allison Malotsky.
Hi, I have a question. This was so interesting. What's the source of the oil lasting for 8 days? Like the oil that was only supposed to last for one day, lasting for eight?
Well, that's in the Talmud. And it's very, very possible that this is an ancient tradition. But, you know, we only have a tiny splice of literature that's being produced in the late Second Temple period. So all these sources have older sources. We don't have all their older sources. So all we have to work with is the Talmud, which preserves the story, which likely has older origins, which we do not have.
Okay. So it's in the Talmud, the miracle, like in... Mm-hmm. Okay.
Any other questions? Well, I am happy to turn it over to Mrs. Katz if you have any announcements or if there's a way that you want to end the talk.
Great. Thank you so much, Malka. I really appreciate it. It's always exciting to learn something new about Hanukkah, especially when that means getting even older and older and into different and different texts. So thank you so much this evening. It was really, really interesting, and we really appreciated you speaking to us. Everyone have a happy Hanukkah. Stay warm, stay healthy. And we look forward to having you continue to learn with us in the future. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.